The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
From Radio America and the American Veterans Center, this is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators recall and retell their personal stories, serving our nation in times of war. And now, Veterans Chronicles.
On the night of July 5th, 1964, Roger Donlin, the young captain of the Special Forces Detachment A-726 at Camp Nam Dong in Vietnam, told his team sergeant, "Get everyone buttoned up tight tonight. The VC are coming." At 2:26 a.m., a large Viet Cong force launched a full-scale attack on Nam Dong, barraging the camp with mortar shells, grenades, and machine gun fire. Over the next 5 hours, Captain Donlin showed immense courage, eliminating several enemy attackers and dragging his wounded sergeant to safety despite having sustained severe wounds. Although Donlin's team was outnumbered 3-1, they managed to hold on to the camp, due in large part to Captain Donlin's unflinching leadership in the face of terrible odds. For his valor, Roger Donlin would be awarded the Medal of Honor, making him the first recipient of the Vietnam War and the first Special Forces recipient in U.S. military history. In this episode of Veterans Chronicles, retired Army Colonel Roger Donlin sits down with guest host Dr. Louis Sorley to recount a career highlighted by his being presented the U.S. military's highest award. Our story begins with Donlin's remembrance of his childhood in New York and his early dreams of serving in the U.S. military.
This is Louis Sorley for Veterans Chronicles. We're talking with Colonel Roger Donlin, a Vietnam veteran of the United States Army. Welcome, sir.
Proud to be with you.
Thanks a lot. Let's start, if you would, please, by telling us something of your origins, where you were born, what your family background was, your early schooling.
Born and raised in Saugerties, New York, on the Hudson River, about 10 miles outside of Woodstock. Born into a family of 10 children. Daddy served in World War I. All four brothers were in service. We grew up with service mentioned every day of our lives. At every time we had a meal together, Mother would make sure we included in our grace, praying for everybody who ever served and who are serving. And that's where I think my dream started, that I would be able to serve someday.
What number were you of the 10?
I'm number 8 out of 10. In fact, in infancy, a sister on one side and a brother on the other side died. And so I was kind of right in the middle there. So I was a lucky one.
Did you go through school in Saugerties?
Saugerties, St. Mary's of the Snow, parochial school, 8 years there with the Sisters of Charity, and then to public school, Saugerties High School. Had the privilege to study Latin for a few years, and sometime later in my life I was got a call, and they said that this is the National Education Association. You are to receive our highest award. And I said, I believe you have the wrong number. You should hang up and try again. I wasn't the greatest scholar. So they hung up and called back. And they said, well, let us tell you about this award. It's an award recognizing you for your achievements, but you, in turn, select the teacher who has the greatest impact on your life.
Oh, what a privilege.
And I said, oh, my gosh, that's great. That's Miss Eleanor Lent. No, we don't want to know who it is. We're just giving you a telephonic alert, and it'll be coming in writing. I says, it won't change. And it did. So, and she was my Latin teacher. And went to Atlantic City for the National Convention and stood right there. And I was all excited about being able to do this. And as we were getting ready to come on stage, the AMC says, okay, you go out there and stand right where that X is on the floor. And that's the same place where Miss America stands every year to get crowned. And whatever thoughts I had in my mind went out the window.
They evaporated.
Yeah. But we stayed in touch with Miss Lent, and she lived to 97 years old.
That's wonderful.
My 50th high school reunion, they said, Roger, we'd like you to get Miss Lent to be our guest. So my wife Norma and I, we went to see Miss Lent and said, Eleanor, we'd like you to be our guest. She says, you know, it's my policy never to go to class reunions. They say it's favoritism, so I've never gone to one. I said, I'm not leaving until you change your policy. So half hour, an hour, went by hour and a half, and Eleanor says, Norma, she's not to me, but she looks at my wife, she says, I will come under one condition. And Norma says, what's that? If somebody tells me who put that weasel on my desk the last day of school. For 50 years, she's been wanting to know it, and my great classmates pinned it on me that night. And I honestly didn't do it.
You didn't do it, but you took the blame.
Yeah, it's one of the pranks I didn't do.
Were you a scout growing up?
Yes, I was privileged to join scouts. Very special in my pocket here is a compass that I carry. It's the type that I was introduced to in Boy Scout Troop 36, and I carry it with me as a tangible reminder that I have to check my compasses every day. This was given to me when the hometown invited me, family, and members of my team from Vietnam to come back and have a big Donlin Day celebration for 3 or 4 days. And during that time, they went with the scout troop, and they gave me this compass and the certificate of record for Tenderfoot.
Yeah.
It's the only thing I have with my father's signature on it.
Oh, how wonderful.
He signed knowing that he was on his deathbed.
Oh,
so dear. So scout leaders became my surrogate father. One of them was Edward M. Flanagan, Sr., and the others. So I've been able, privileged to continue to be involved one way or another with scouting.
After high school, where did you go?
I went to Syracuse University and New York State College of Forestry.
And were you a forestry major?
That was in my intent. And in order to survive, I had to have a job. So I got a job as a head waiter in Zeta Tau Alpha, a sorority house. So I wasn't a very disciplined student, so I lasted a year there as a student.
And then what?
Then I had to take a new course. And I went and worked in the landscape industry just to keep myself focused. And during that time, I said, you know, I need to get in the Army or get in the Air Force. And I said, I want to fly. So that's when I enlisted in the Air Force.
And did you have any commitments when you enlisted? Did you enlist for something specific?
Well, my goal was to go to flight school. And then while I was in boot camp, the word came out, and, hey, there's this new school they're going to open up out there in Colorado called the Air Academy. And they're taking, so I said, man, I'll apply for that. So I put all my paperwork in and went through. And they said, okay, you go to that prep school at Stuart Field in Newburgh, New York. So I went there, and everything was going well. We were getting brushed up on our math and English. And a week or so before we were supposed to go to Colorado, they gave us other physicals, and Donlin got dilated eyes again. And the doctor says, I believe Rasta 19 may have a congenital cataract in the left eye. Scratch, Rasta 19.
That was you?
That was me.
Oh, dear.
So I was a little disappointed at that point.
I guess you were devastated.
But reset my compass, and there's this other school right up the river called West Point. So I was able to make it in there, lasted a year, and I'll digress a little bit. But a few years ago, I was in Kansas City, and the 2nd Division was having their reunion. And Norma reminded me, you have never made one, and it's so close, you should go. So I went and passed this office, and the people were having a meeting, and it was honorary colonel of the regiment in there, and I just stuck my head to see what was going on. He said, come on in, Donlin. Good to see you again. I didn't recognize him. He stood up, and he limped a little bit, and I, yep, you don't remember me. Yeah, you hurt my feelings, Donlin. How about Section 22, math, class of 59? That's the bottom of the barrel. He's the guy that washed me out. So, good Lord had other things in mind for me.
So where did that take you then?
Well, they took me down to New York, and I was looking for a job, and I was walking along, a little country boy still mesmerized by Empire State Buildings and such. And I had two brothers that had gotten out of the Air Force and gone to work for IBM. And I saw that world headquarters there, and they used to joke, IBM, that stands for I've Been Moved. And Mr. Watson was the founder and president.
Yeah.
So I felt pretty cocky. Walked in there and went to personnel and said I was looking for a job. And it just so happened Mr. Watson was going by and said hi to his personnel director. And I don't know how, but I got introduced to him and went in, had a cup of coffee. And I'm looking for a job. I got hired.
by the boss.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Well, I was hired because the last thing I did, I spent a year at West Point.
Yes.
And he asked about sports, and I said, I played a little lacrosse and fell in love with that game and told him I had great memories about winning a couple of pints of ice cream when I beat this guy that challenged me in a sprint of 100 yards, a guy named Don Hollander. And I didn't know who he was. He was just an upperclassman. Turned out to be an All-American end, and he challenged me again. I won 2 pints of ice cream.
Hmm.
And then after I did that, that's how I ended up with lacrosse. He went and see Coach Touchstone. And
Stan
said, hey,
Touchstone.
I got a plebe that might have some legs on him. If we train him right, Coach says, well, put him in cross country to get him ready. I said, man, what kind of favor did this guy do to me?
Yeah.
Going over those hills at 10 clicks a day or so.
Yes.
But that's life.
So did you actually go to work for IBM then?
Yes, I worked for them for a while and then fell in love, got married too early, and we moved to Louisiana. And I was, again, looking for a job, and I was standing outside the hall, and I read the bulletin board, and there was this little article about the chancellor, a guy named Troy Middleton.
Oh, yes.
And I said, boy, that's familiar. Major Middleton was our exec at the prep school. I wonder if there's any relation. So he goes walking by, and I said, good morning, sir. And he kind of turned around. And who are you? What are you doing? I find it interesting here. You have a son named Troy? He says, I should be asking more questions. I says, come on in, have a cup of coffee. And I had a cup of coffee, I got hired. Actually, I forget his son's middle name, but it was a very uncommon middle name. And I used it, and he said, how'd you find that out? And I says, well, the truth be known, we got the first sergeant snockered one night, and we got into the files in the orderly room.
So you're taking a number of divergent paths before you finally wind up as a military professional.
Yeah, the Lord was challenging me.
What happened after this Louisiana excursion?
I had the bug, and I came home one day, and I said, I saw a recruiting sergeant, and that's when I came back in, went to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, took my oath on Canal Street in New Orleans.
When was this about?
1958.
Yeah.
I learned a little about Southern culture when they said, come to the football game. Billy Cannon was a big football player at the time.
Yes.
I said, good, I'll get my sweats on and an old shirt. No, we go coat and tie. And I said, oh, wow, this is different. Mm-hmm. Their chicory is one thing down here where they go to dressed up to football games. And then they sang two national anthems. One that said, what's that thing called, Dixie? Oh, yeah, that was it. Yeah, that was another part of my education.
Yes.
Anyway, I re-enlisted and went to Fort Chaffee.
When Veterans Chronicles returns, Colonel Donlan recalls his ambitions to go to Officer Candidate School and the hospitalization that put his dream on hold. You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. Roger Donlan grew up dreaming of a career in the U.S. Army. Yet just when it appeared his career was taking off, a medical issue landed him in the hospital at Fort Jaffe.
They then had my goals on OCS and got messed up, ended up in the hospital. There's a little guy that moved in the barracks next to me, and there's a lot of press excited about it because he played the guitar. Anyway, it was Elvis Presley.
Yeah. Did you actually meet him?
No, I was in the hospital. I'd sit there and read all the stuff that was going on, how the press were taking pictures, and I said, that doesn't look like any barracks that I've ever seen at Fort Chaffee. But put linoleum on the floor. They put pine wood around the wall lockers and everything, and curtains on the window. The only barracks like that.
Yes.
But that nurse tried to get my MOS changed from infantry to a medic after my couple months stay in the hospital. She took me down one day, one night, we're going down the hallway. She said, I need your help, Donlan. Grab that gurney, and we're going down the hallway. We're going in this ward. She says, you take this. She gives me a 3x5, and it says, 17 sheets, 4 pillowcases, such and such. She says, I have to go talk to the nurse, and while I'm doing that, you just, the closet right there. So I put all that stuff on the gurney, and we're heading back to our ward, and I said, Major Zimmerman, isn't that what you call midnight requisition? She says, of course not. It's taking corrective measures towards improper distribution. I always love that.
Yeah.
I'll never forget her. Phyllis Zimmerman. So that was a little bit at Fort Chaffee time, and I went from there to Fort Benning and OCS and graduated and got commissioned about 2 years, 2 months, 2 weeks after my class of 59. So, and I've stayed in touch with those guys over there.
Well, I would think so. I mean, if you went to the basic officers course, you may well have encountered some of them again right away, did you?
Oh, yeah, jump school.
So after you finished OCS and you're commissioned in, obviously, in the infantry, and you do whatever initial schooling there is, what's your first unit of assignment then?
Manchus, 1st and 9th Infantry.
And where were they?
Alaska. Mechanized infantry, M-59s
in the Arctic. In Alaska.
God, what did you do wrong? You didn't hurt that. That was a challenge.
Getting them started might have been a little bit of a challenge.
It was great, though. We had a guy, Colonel Frank Naughton, was our battle group commander, and a D-Day veteran. And CG used to say he's the best soldier I've ever known. He finished high school, and that was about it. And he was general officer material, but they weren't going to promote anybody that didn't have a degree.
Oh.
They tried like heck everything.
Yeah.
He's a great, great guy. Yeah, one morning, go by my tent on skis. We're out in the boonies. Hey, Donlin, come on out here. I hear you want to go to ski instructor school. Young lieutenant, the colonel's talking. Yes, sir. So you say, yes, sir. So off we go. Out of the field, 8-9 weeks TDY to Fort Greeley. That was where I met Sergeant Morales, our ski instructor. Two great things he did. First day he found out I had a fear of skis. He watched me. He says, man, what happened in your life? I says, well, have you ever been on skis? I says, one time. I says, I got up early and we had one pair of skis for a whole gang of kids. And I took them over to this big estate by the Hudson River. Got up there and it was early. I was all by myself feeling real proud. And I got down. Man, I made it all the way down the bottom of that hill. It was fresh foot of snow. And there was top strand of barbed wire fence. Got me right across the ankle. I got so mad from being stupid. Took those skis over to the old big estate. Put them on the drive. There's a little, right through the boathouse out onto the Hudson River. I said, oh, God, what did I do now? So I didn't fall through the ice. I retrieved the skates.
Now, is this Sergeant Morales anything to do with the Sergeant Morales Club?
No. But he does have that same distinction in my mind.
Yeah.
Because he got the 12 of us novice and hopeful skiers. And when we got back to the Quonset hut at night, he said, put everything away, forget what you did, and come on over here and put your footlockers. And he pour footlockers around. And he put a little table out in the middle of it and put out a chessboard.
Uh-huh.
And he taught us all how to play chess.
Oh, great.
And the deal was we all chipped in to buy a set at the PX, and whoever won the last game got the chessboard.
Okay.
Here we are leaving after 9 weeks on the top of our duffel bags waiting for the bus. Chessboard's there. And I outlasted the other guy. He got frostbite, I think.
You got the board.
I got the board.
Yeah. We will fast forward to your service, early service in Vietnam, if you'd. Please take us to that and tell us how you got there in the first place.
Privileged and honored to serve in U.S. Army Special Forces, commanded Detachment A-726, and we were sent on something we hear more of these days, to train, assist, and advise indigenous force.
When did this begin?
May of 64, and we were there 6 weeks when we had zero intelligence, and our adversaries had all the intelligence on us gathered through their own sources, how they coerced, threatened, kidnapped, assassinated local leaders, took children, threatened them that they would kill their parents or grandparents if they didn't pace off something in our camp or around our camp. Same thing that happens today in different parts of the world. It was that version of terrorism. And we were in the throes of making plans to relocate closer to the ocean border. And I think they were fully aware of that also and thought we might have been a little disjointed. They successfully moved in about a force 800 or 900 and surrounded us and pounced on us and gave us a real run for our money. But during our training, we agreed that we would never go down and allow anybody to be captured. And we fought that way.
Colonel Roger Donlin recounts the fateful night when the Viet Cong descended on his camp at Nam Dong when Veterans Chronicles returns. In the spring of 1964, Roger Donlin was deployed as commander of Special Forces Team A-726 to Camp Nam Dong in Vietnam, about 15 miles from the Laotian border. As our story concludes, Colonel Donlin recalls the betrayal of local mercenaries who turned out to be sympathizers of the Viet Cong.
There's superiorly outnumbered by a force. But the ace up our sleeve was I had 60 Chinese mercenaries, 40 when I arrived, and the day before we got hit, I got, or a couple of days, I got 20 more.
Uh-huh.
And so I put four of those in each of the five mortar pits, gave them some handheld flares. It was the newest high-tech thing that we had. Since we had to use 81, it was the only thing we had for a flare. But they hit us hard. They penetrated the outer perimeter, inner perimeter. And by trips back after the war, I met with former adversaries and confirmed in my own mind what the real situation was, is that the Katu mountain tribe in the area had already been co-opted by the NVA and the VC, so that was working against us. And they also had, of the 300 that we were training, of the locals, 100 were VC sympathizers. And when the attack started, turned on us immediately. So when I met the former adversary, he said, I commended him for the performance of his men on the battlefield. And then he kind of rubbed it in my nose, saying, yeah, we penetrated your outer perimeter, inner perimeter. And I immediately said, I looked him right in the eye, I said, yeah, anybody that came in the inner perimeter never left. And he didn't miss a beat. And he says, all 18 of them. And then he wanted to know why. How were you able to resist, and how come we were not victorious? And that was an interesting dialogue during the day. And
yes.
Yeah. But
how many Americans did you have with you?
I had my 12-man Special Forces team, and
right.
Then we had the 60 mercenaries.
Yes.
And then I had my counterpart, Vietnamese, who turned out to be a traitor. And
really?
The S2 was a traitor.
Really?
Yeah. And my Chinese had a great...
Did that become apparent during the battle?
No. Well, the counterpart, my Vietnamese captain, he got in a foxhole and stayed there. He stayed with Doc Hickey. And the counterpart had a Hawaiian shirt on. That was his safety tag. The others that were in there who were turncoats stripped their uniform off, and they were wearing brightly colored loincloths. And that was their pass for the night, because that was the uniform of the sappers. So it got spicy right away. And we took casualties, and my youngest, Sergeant John Houston, was killed. He just shared with me the night before the letter he got from Alice. He's going to be proud parents of twins. And that news, Alice gave premature birth. One survived. John Houston Jr. is buried with his father in Arlington. It's a headstone on one side. Sergeant John L. Houston, U.S. Army, Distinguished Service Cross, Purple Heart. 6 July, 64. And on the other side, John L. Houston, Jr., 8 wow. July, 1964.
Wow.
So it was...
How long did the battle last?
Through the night. Started about 2, and after daybreak, they broke off when some Marine choppers, HMM 162, came in with a reaction force, a strike of Nungs from other Special Forces camps. It's a little footnote history, which is embarrassing. There were no such thing as a reaction force in existence when we got hit.
Really?
Yeah, because we were just really in the early days getting setting up camps. In recent times, you know Scott Krierar.
Yes, I do.
He called me and said, hey, Roger, we're doing an audit trail on our quick reaction force. And we got back as far as Nam Dong, where we found out that's where it started.
Yeah.
I says, thanks. Could have been a couple of hours earlier.
Would have been helpful.
Been most appreciated.
Yes.
Yeah, the Marine choppers came out, and the sound of them, they could have been there in 20 minutes. It was a couple hours later because there was a lot of other things going on. It was 4th of July weekend, and other people were doing other things. But the fact that they got there made a little noise, gave us some hope. But then they left.
Did you get any support during the night, like flare ships or anything of that nature?
No, a flare ship was supposed to come, and that was not fueled, no flares on the ship, and it was locked in the hangar, and everybody was downtown getting smoked. So we were smoking in another sense out in the boonies.
Yes.
But the good Lord was with us. We fed off each other, and as any team worth its salt does, when one goes down, somebody else picks up the slack, and that's what got us through the night.
Were you injured?
Yeah, they got me 4 times. My medic says 7 times, but he took care of 3 on the battlefield, and the hospital took care of the other 4.
And were you evacuated then afterward?
They tried to get me back to the States, but somehow my Aussie friend and I missed shipment.
Okay.
I was able to spend my 6 months in Vietnam.
When did you learn that you were recommended for the Medal of Honor?
Well, there was one rumor. I was listening to General Westmoreland greet a new group, and he just mentioned to the group, he says, there's some people in the hospital over here that they had a good, pretty good fight recently, and there's recommendations for the highest awards going in there, and I didn't pay any attention to it. And then all of a sudden people start asking a lot of questions, and I, in the meantime, got myself lined up for a job with Delta. And then when the group commander found out, he pulled my butt off of that. He went, I said, something's brewing, and then it stuck me in the ops office. And
now, I think you then went to work with General Westmoreland. Am I right about that?
No, never went to work directly for him. We all under John Spears was the group commander when I was there, former chief of infantry branch, who counseled me when I said I wanted to go special forces. He said, you never go special forces, Donovan, to be the kiss of death. Man, I went to Vietnam and there he was sitting behind a desk. I went and reported to him, sir, this is the first time I ever reported to a hypocrite. He did return my salute. God almighty, how long am I going to be here? Finally returned it. He said, Donovan, your mouth's going to get you in trouble. I says, well, you do surprise me, sir. You advise me and a lot of other people not to come this route.
And there he was.
Yeah, commander of us.
Yes,
God almighty.
Well, you had a wonderful career and you wound up as a colonel. What was your last assignment?
My last assignment, in my mind, was I wore a UN hat for 4 years in Japan. And that was my most significant. But my last technical assignment, I was with the Physical Disability Agency at San Francisco, Presidio.
Presidio of San Francisco.
Yes. So when we requested, I requested to go to the West Coast someplace so my children could get to know Norma's, my wife's parents a little bit because they'd never been around them.
Yeah.
Mission was accomplished.
Besides your wonderful military service, I know that in recent years you practically devote yourself full-time to veterans and scouts and other worthwhile endeavors like that. And we're talking while you're here at this annual convention of the American Veterans Center for Veterans Day. It's been a privilege talking with you. Thank you very much for telling us your story. This is Louis Sorley for Veterans Chronicles. We've been talking with Colonel Roger Donlan, United States Army veteran of the Vietnam War. Thank you, sir.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center in association with Pelcom Communications.